Welcome. Today is the 7th of December, 2014, the feast day of St. Ambrose, the second Sunday of Advent, and the Vigil of the Immaculate Conception. Although today, I'm joined by Mike Duddy, and we're going to be talking about an entirely non-religious topic. And so you'll recall that in the third episode of my podcast, it was called Why Catholics Should Care About 9/11. And I talked about different issues there that just don't add up with the official story at 9/11. So today, we'll be talking with Mike Duddy about, well, why we don't really trust the government story and why it doesn't add up. So, Mike, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Ryan. Well, when you say, why don't we trust the government story, that's kind of a big canvas because there's so many government stories, it would be impossible to deal with all of them. The 9/11 event was such a huge, complex event. It involved, but most people, when they think of 9/11, the majority of Americans just think in terms of Tower 1 and 2. Okay, but as we know, there was a multiple events. There was the Pentagon event, where allegedly a quote-unquote plane struck the Pentagon. Then there's the WTC event, where two planes struck Tower 1 and 2. But as we'll see later, there were seven towers or seven buildings in the World Trade Center complex, and all seven buildings were virtually destroyed, not just one and two. When you say that to most people, they go, huh? And the next thing, of course, is Shanksville, like Flight 93, what really happened to it and what happened at Shanksville. And on top of that, you've got the cover-up aspect, the government stories about 9/11. First of all, the FEMA report. Then you had the Philip Zelikow 9/11 Commission report. And then after that, you had the NIST report. And, of course, all of these things were cover-ups. They were all, none of these organizations really acted scientifically. They all acted politically at the beck and call of the Bush administration to tell the story. And then, of course, finally, there's the who and the why question. And you cannot possibly deal with the who or the why until you find out thoroughly about what happened on 9/11, what actually was the cause. And one of the problems, I think, in the 9/11 truth movement is almost everybody has made the cardinal investigative mistake of starting with theses or hypotheses before they've gathered all the facts. And, you know, as the fictitious Sherlock Holmes used to say, you know, if you start off with a hypothesis before you've gathered all your facts, you're going to end up with a false conclusion. So we have to get all the evidence. We can't start with any hypotheses until all the evidence is collected. And then when we look at the nature of the evidence, then we can start to say, okay, who would have had the ability to do this? Who would have necessarily have had to have been involved? And why did they do it?
Okay, great. And today we're going to be focusing just on New York City, right, and the Trade Center complex. So today we're not addressing issues of the Pentagon or Shanksville or anything else.
Right.
So therefore, let's start off with the first question. What's wrong with the official story as concerns the World Trade Center?
Well, the official story that, you know, 19 hijackers were able to hijack four different airlines and six without being caught on camera at the airports, and that they were able to break into the cockpits with box cutters, and that these guys, none of which had ever flown a 767 or a 757, could have maneuvered a complex plane like this and hit their targets, is just not credible, okay? But given that, let's just assume that, you know, that story, we accept that actually happened and people got planes and they flew around and they actually hit the targets, namely Tower 1 and Tower 2. The official story is that these buildings were hit by an airplane, okay, and that the fires, that the actual plane hitting the building weakened the building, okay? And then the explosion and the fuel that was flowing out of the tanks spread the fire throughout various floors of the buildings, and this terrible fire that was burning for a half hour in the case of the South Tower and an hour in the case of the North Tower weakened this structural building, weakened the structure, and these buildings just collapsed to the ground, okay? Well, in order to understand why that's fictitious and why that's impossible, we have to go back and actually kind of look at the structure of these buildings to see how they were built, what they were composed of, okay? And then we would have to look at the laws of physics and later on the laws of aerodynamics to see if any of these things that the government story told was even hypothetically possible in your wildest dream, okay, let alone in reality. So let's talk for a bit about the structure of Tower 1 and 2, since this is the one that most people seem to be aware of. These buildings, first of all, we know that they were over a quarter of a mile tall. For a while, they were the tallest buildings in the world. North Tower, Tower number 1, was 1,368 feet tall, which is 48 feet taller than a quarter of a mile. Tower 2 was 6 feet shorter. The buildings also were built on bedrock, 7 stories into the ground. So they were firmly anchored into solid rock. Each building had a total of 236 steel columns around its perimeter. Each side was 208 feet long, so it was a 208 foot square. Each floor, just considering the building space for offices, was over an acre. Okay. Now, each of these 236 columns which surrounded these buildings were on an average of about 1 foot square. Now, granted, they started at the lower levels being much bigger, and as they went up, they tapered because you don't need the same strength on the top floors that you would need on the bottom floors. But we'll say pretty much on the areas that were under question, they were pretty close to 1 square foot in diameter. The steel was also anywhere from 1 to 2 inches thick around each of these steel columns. In addition to that, we have 47 even larger columns in the center of the building. Now, when I say the center, I'm talking about almost 40% of the building's volume. This wasn't just a tiny column. The column was huge. So if you looked at it, it's almost 40% of the whole floor isn't floor in the sense of office buildings. It's this center core, which acts as a stabilizing center for the buildings, okay? So here we got 236 columns, we got 47 columns in the middle. Now, on the top several floors of these buildings, we have what was called a head truss, a hat truss. And what the hat truss did, it was like a hat that was put on the top of the building that connected with each of the 47 central steel columns and connected with each of the 236 perimeter columns and joined them together. And it didn't just join them together, there was a flexibility. So let's say, for example, hypothetically, one of the walls got damaged, one of the perimeter walls. The head truss would shift the weight from that damaged wall, take the burden off that wall, and distribute it to the other three walls and the central column. Now, the central column was so strong that it could carry the whole weight of the building 4 or 5 times just by itself. And then you add to that that the perimeter walls also could have carried the weight of the building probably at least 2 times because they had the ability to shift their weight also, okay? Now, in addition to the hat truss, on each floor, we also have what is called a spandrel. It is a thick steel belt, okay, about 2 to 3 inches thick. So each three of these columns, each of these three of the perimeter, each of the 236 perimeter columns were joined together by a spandrel, which is about 2.5, 3 feet wide, or tall rather, and 2 to 3 inches thick, and they were bolted and welded on. In addition to that, the spandrels, if you looked at them, they would be like a Wheatchex, okay, like your little Wheatchex cereals. Mm-hmm. Only they weren't just on each floor separately. They were designed in such a way so that they would go back and forth together. They would interconnect with like one floor and two floor would have part of the same Wheatchex. They wouldn't just be like Wheatchex all around the perimeter. Mm-hmm. You would have them overlapping, which gave it even additional strength. Okay. Now, we also have what was connecting the perimeter walls with the central column was also trusses. So on each floor, you had these huge double trusses that anchored into the spandrel and then went over and anchored into the columns in the central wall. And then each of these trusses also had steel that would reinforce each of the piece within the truss. Mm-hmm. So you had this huge complexity of overlapping fortresses that were giving strength to this building. Mm-hmm. Then on top of the trusses, you had a steel pan, a very thick steel corrugated pan, which also was anchored to the trusses and was anchored to the spandrel and anchored to the central columns. In that pan was several inches of concrete. Okay. On the outside of the building, we had aluminum cladding. Okay. So, in the World Trade Center, we had a total of 200,000 tons of steel in the entire World Trade Center complex. That includes all seven buildings. So that would bring it out to probably close to 70,000 tons of steel in each of the towers themselves.
70,000
tons of steel in each tower. On top of that, we have a total of 425,000 tons of concrete. Now, the concrete was mostly in the floor pans, and it was in the stairwell encasements, and of course, some of it was in the basement. But 425,000 tons of concrete. We had 43,600 windows in the two towers. That's 600,000 square feet of glass. 239 elevators, 71 escalators, 200 miles of steel heating duct, thousands of miles of wire. Okay. Now, in addition to that, remember, those are load-bearing factors. Mm-hmm. Within the building itself, on each floor, we also have non-load-bearing floors. You've got all these walls for offices, you know, that were, because there was, each floor had, you know, different tenants. So it's fair to see that this building was really very heavy. They estimate that each building was approximately 500,000 tons. Mm-hmm. Tower 1 was 500,000 tons, and Tower 2 was 500,000 tons. And that doesn't include all the materials that were in the building, like furniture and, you know, and all the other stuff that was added.
Desks, coffee makers.
Coffee makers, food. Remember they're reading some days. Every day there was something like 60,000 tons of food delivered to the building. It was just,
wow.
You know, it was just outrageous, the weight of these buildings, okay?
So this building is the possibly, you know, one of the most well-constructed buildings that, you know, in modern history. What happens to it in the morning of September 11th, 2001?
Well, at 8:46 in the morning, New York time, World Trade Center 1, the North Tower, is struck, quote-unquote, by a plane, quote-unquote, traveling at allegedly 490 miles an hour, and it crashes into the upper floors of the building. Okay. At 9:03, About 20 minutes later, another plane, another 767, crashes into Tower 2, you know, at the 80th floor, between the 80th and 90th floors, crashes into the south side of the tower. This time, they say at 590 miles an hour, okay? So we've got two buildings that are hit within 20 minutes apart. Interestingly, building number two collapses at 9:59, less than an hour later after it's hit. And the North Tower collapses at 10:28, you know, much longer, even though it was the building first hit, it collapses much later than the second building. Okay. They claim that each plane had about 10,000 gallons of fuel, okay, jet fuel, which is basically kerosene. Mm-hmm. Even though a 767 can carry about 24,000 gallons, airlines don't carry that much fuel for domestic flights. They only use that for transcontinental flights because of the tremendous weight. You know, it would be too costly to burn up fuel too fast. And if the plane had to do a ditch landing with that much fuel, you know, the damage would be greater. So they usually, the plane probably started off from, assuming there was a plane, 11,000 gallons of fuel from Boston, and by the time it got to New York, it was probably maybe down to 10,000 gallons. Okay, so we're expected to believe that 10,000 gallons of fuel, you just saw how these buildings were constructed with steel and concrete, that 10,000 gallons of fuel were able to weaken the steel and cause the buildings to collapse in less than 10 seconds, in less than free fall speed of a billiard ball in a vacuum.
Well, that's precisely what the NIST report says. In fact, they go on to claim the official story is that, well, fire did inflict enough damage to, enough column damage, that is, to destroy the buildings. And they further claim that this is an undocumented collapse sequence, and more or less saying this is something we've never seen before due to thermal expansion. And Sanders, who gave the press conference, says anyone who's ever run a tight jar lid underwater to help loosen it knows that the metal expands when it gets hot. And so heat also causes steel to lose its strength and stiffness. Thermal expansion occurs at temperatures much lower than those required to reduce steel strength and stiffness. So and he then the NIST report claims this with respect to WTC-7, which we'll get to in a little bit. But nevertheless, so this is their claim, of course, that thermal expansion is what caused all these. Is that possible? Can that happen?
Well, it's never, ever happened, which NIST admits. That they've never seen this before in a building, and they're right, because there has been several huge buildings that have caught on fire, steel-framed buildings built similarly, but not anywhere near as good as the World Trade Centers. One, the first one, of course, was the Meridian Plaza building in Philadelphia, which was like a three-story blazing fire, and it was going on for hours and hours and hours, and when the firemen finally got the fire out, there wasn't even any warp beams, you know. Matter of fact, when they rebuilt the Meridian Plaza, they didn't even replace any of the beams. They just, you know, scraped the, you know, the burnt paint off it, whatever, and went ahead and put new walls on what was there. And the same with several other buildings. One I can remember personally was in Los Angeles when the 62-story, at that time it was called the Interstate Bank Building, downtown Los Angeles, had a huge fire on several floors. And I was downtown when that was going on. And I remember the news helicopters couldn't get close to the building because the heat was just so incredible. And I remember the commentators were saying, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? This building's so tall, they're going to have to tear it down and there's top floors and start over, you know. And of course, the same thing, the building's still there today. They just went ahead and just put new walls on, left the steel structure in place. There has never been, and there's been some doozies. There was a couple of buildings that lasted for days. And, steel has to heat for at least 2,700 degrees for an enhanced period of time to melt. Kerosene at the maximum can only get to 1,200 degrees. Mm-hmm. So you're coming up 1,000 degrees short, mm-hmm. you know, to melt steel.
Right.
But let's look at one of the to put this whole thing in perspective. To look at what we just talked about, the size of the buildings, mm-hmm. to give the mind a conceptual vision of this, it takes 7.48 U.S. fluid gallons to fill up 1 cubic foot of space, okay? So if there were 10,000 gallons of fuel in these airplanes when they went into the side of the building, that gives us a total of a mere 1,337 cubic feet. Now, let's translate that volume into size. That translates into a room about 12 feet long by 12 feet wide by 9.3 feet tall. Now, you take that tiny little room and put it into the cubic foot volume of each tower, which was 59,185,000 cubic feet. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a little grain of sand inside a rain barrel. Now, to think that that much fuel in this tiny little pea in a silo is going to cause thermal expansion of 236 columns and 47 columns and spandrels and trusses and concrete, and it's going to cause this building within less than a half an hour, Tower 2, and an hour for Tower 1, to fall to the ground in dust in less than a billiard ball can hit the ground is just absurd. You know, it's think of it. But let's add one other element to this story. When the so-called planes hit the building, what happened? It exploded. Fireball. That would have to mean that all that fuel that hit was immediately dissipated. It wasn't around to create fires, okay? I mean, go ahead and take a gallon of gas and set it out in your front yard and throw a match in it. Does just part of it blow up and the rest of the gas sits there? You know, it all goes kaboom, you know. So they come back and say, oh, well, but it caused the building to catch on fire. Okay, well, the building was composed of hydrocarbons, you know, wood paneling, carpets, stuff like that. And there is no way. I mean, these other buildings, the Meridian Plaza and the Interstate Building, had all that stuff. There wasn't any thermal expansion. There wasn't any thermal weakness, you know, of their buildings. Buildings which didn't have a center core, didn't have a truss hat, you know, didn't have these all these other things that were anchoring the building together like the World Trade Center did. So there just isn't any possibility that this little pea in a silo, most of which was exploded, could possibly have enough potential energy to transform that much steel. And it just didn't just cause the steel to weaken, according to the story. It caused it to disappear. You know, and remember, to get to melting point, it's got to be 2,700 degrees.
Right.
Now, it's got to be a lot more to get it to disappear. You're probably talking thousands of degrees above that.
Right.
You know, so it's just, but fire obviously didn't do it, nor did the impact of a plane hitting the side of the building do it. As a matter of fact, when the buildings were built, they took into consideration that a plane could possibly strike the building because they were so tall. And at that time, the largest aircraft was a 707, and the engineers actually calculated a 707 crashing into the side of a building. And a 707 is not much smaller than a 767. Mm-hmm. Very little size difference. Mm.
Couldn't the engineers have just got it wrong?
But
sure,
yeah,
somebody will be
saying
that.
Yeah, they could have, but NIST couldn't have gotten anything wrong.
Of course not.
Yeah.
A couple of times now you've said the so-called planes, and that's going to strike a lot of people as funny or even nuts. Mm-hmm. Some people, whoa, you mean there were no planes? I saw them. They're on the TV. There's got to be planes. And so people are going to say, oh, God, these guys are nuts. I'm not going to listen to that. But if you're saying that, I ask you just to hold on. So now the next question is, what was the altitude of the planes, according to the official story, when they hit the towers? And how does this fit with the known physics of air travel?
Well, first of all, we know that there are various speeds that pilots have to learn about when they fly airplanes. And one of the speeds is called the VOM. It's the maximum operation that a plane can fly at a given altitude. Mm-hmm. Without jeopardizing the plane, having the plane fall apart at the seams, okay? Planes are designed to fly at their cruising altitude at maximum speed, which they call VN. Okay. A 767 can fly at about 570 miles an hour at 35,000 feet because there's less friction up there. The air is thinner. Mm-hmm. At the altitude, at sea level, now remember the towers in New York were only 1,000 feet at the top. Okay, they were less than a quarter of a mile tall. So we're talking only 1,300 feet, okay, at most, mm-hmm. which means the plane would have to fly within its VOM. It couldn't fly faster than the VOM for a 767 is about 300 miles an hour, okay? So if the plane were to fly much faster than 300 miles an hour, it would unravel. I mean, it would start, the wings would break off, the fuselage, the horizontal stabilizer, the vertical stabilizers, the fuselage skin, as you might say, would just start to rip off and the plane would bust into hundreds of pieces. Secondly, because of the fan jet engines on these planes, it is impossible for a plane to fly that fast at 1,000 feet sea level. It can't process the oxygen necessary to even create that kind of speed. And there's a thing in a plane, too. It's called the clacker. When a plane starts to get dangerously close to its maximum operating speed, this loud clacking noise will come on, which is just nerve-wracking. Everything will start to shake, and it'll scream and yell, and it gets the pilot's attention. It says, slow down, buddy. You know,
kind of like rumble strips.
Like rumble strips in the air, you might say. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the plane could not possibly have flown at the speeds, mm-hmm. you know, that they're saying. What do they say? They say the first one was 400 and some miles an hour, 450 miles an hour, and the one that hit Tower 2 was 590 miles, flying faster than its top speed at 35,000 feet. It's flying this at less than 1,000 feet above sea level, mm-hmm. to almost 100 and some miles faster than its VOM. It just could not have happened. Nor would the engines even allow it to fly at a level of flight. The other interesting thing is, we saw the planes hit. Okay, well, we see lots of things on television that don't exist. I mean, that's what movie special effects are all about. That's what CGI computerization is all about. Computer generated images, which can be done instantaneously. We see it on football games all the time. You know, with the line of scrimmage and the first and 10 and all that stuff is always there. And you see it at the Olympics when they, you know, project the person's flag and all stuff on the ice as they're skating. You know, it's a computer science. So projecting an airplane on the screen would be an easy thing to do. And what's interesting is in the live feeds, local television that morning, when you look at when the people are talking about planes, and they're showing that you don't see any planes at all. It's not until later on in the afternoon when it goes national that all of a sudden the planes get put in the picture. So it's not at all conceivable that CGIs had to be used. And we know according to the laws of physics there had to be because the plane simply cannot fly that fast. Mm-hmm. Now, there's two other things that should easily prove that it couldn't have happened. When the North Tower is hit, we see the okay. When we see the first plane hit the tower, there's an easy test you can do. If you have a video of it, and you see the plane come onto the screen, and you all of a sudden stop it, you still frame it, and then you go ahead and you count the number of frames or clicks on your VCR machine that it would take to get the plane from when it first enters your television screen to the time the nose comes up against the side of the building. Mm-hmm. And let's say it's 13, okay? So you would stop right there and you put like a little yellow line, okay, on your TV screen where the nose of the plane is up against the building. And then you start counting clicks again as the amount of time it takes the plane to go through the building. And we'll see it's the same 13 clicks. Mm-hmm. Whatever happened to Newton's third law? Right. You know, you got a plane, you see this plane going through the building with no resistance at all, and it glides through the building, nothing falls off. In other words, if you took a model airplane and you built it out of plastic, and you went up to your concrete wall in the backyard and you threw it at that wall, what's going to happen to that plane? It's going to bust apart and it's going to fall back from the wall and fall into, you know, dozens of pieces down into the ground. Mm-hmm. Well, here we see a plane, which is virtually a hollow piece of machinery. You got a hollow tube in the fuselage. You got virtually hollow wings, which carry the fuel, by the way. You got a hollow, virtually hollow vertical stabilizer, which is the big tail piece on the end. And you got virtually hollow horizontal stabilizers. So you've got these hollow pieces of material going through a building surrounded by 1 foot in diameter, 2 inch thick steel columns that are buttressed by steel trusses with concrete floor pans. Now the picture shows that a plane hits the building at a 26 degree angle, okay? 26 degree angle, wingtip to wingtip, covers about 6 floors. Mm-hmm. So here you got a hollow airplane coming up at a 26 degree angle sideways, sort of, crashing through 6 floors mm-hmm. of concrete and steel in dozens of steel columns mm-hmm. and goes right through it.
Right.
Nothing falls off, nothing goes back. And it does it without any resistance from the building. Mm-hmm. Now, what does Newton's third law tell us? Basically, for every action, there is an opposite and equal reaction. Okay.
Right.
Now, there's two ways you can look at that. Okay. It's easy to be fooled if you think about an airplane. Let's say an airplane going 500 miles an hour crashes into a big building, and you see it go through, like we saw on television. The mind could say, yeah, I could do that because the plane's so small and it's going so fast and it's going right through this big building.
Particularly if you're just thinking of it as going through glass and a few, you know, weak aluminum and canvas dividers that create your little cubicle world that you have to sit into. But we're talking it's coming in at an angle through various floors. That means it's also going through concrete and steel and not merely just the glass.
Spandrels and trusses and concrete, and which is also being reinforced by the 47 columns in the center and being reinforced by the hat truss on the top.
Right.
But what's interesting is when you see the plane go through, how is it that hollow wings from tip to tip go through and don't break off? Have you ever seen an airplane crash or any picture anywhere of an airplane crash where the wings and all that stuff just don't come flying onto into dozens and scores of pieces? Mm-hmm. I've seen pictures of an airplane where a duck hits it.
Right.
And it goes right through the wing. I mean, it's like it was shot with a cannon. Mm. So it's just not... going back to Newton's law. Let's look at Newton's law from the other side of the equation. It's the same thing as saying you have that airplane standing in the air still, resting on top of a flagpole, let's say, okay? And you have this big 500,000-ton building on a railroad track coming at 500 miles an hour and hitting the airplane. It's exactly the same thing. Now, in that scenario, would you possibly think that the plane would have gone through the building like a knife through butter?
No.
No way. So when you view Newton's law from the other side of the equation, you see it's absurd.
Right.
Whereas when you view it from the side of the small hitting the big, it's the magician's trick. You know, you can be led to believe it's true.
Right. So that's amazing. And I think a lot of people just psychologically, they're just not prepared for that. But, that's Tower 1 and 2. And we know those went down. How about Tower 7? Tower 7 was not hit by a plane, yet it still collapsed at free fall speed. And the official NIST report is, it was just damaged by the heat from the other two buildings burning. And in fact, NIST, tries to argue because their beams were longer, therefore it was more susceptible to this thermal weakening that they're talking about earlier. So what happens with Tower 7?
Well, let's go back for a second and talk about the collapse factor Towers 1 and 2.
All right, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, let's talk about another law of physics here, okay? We saw that 110 floors, each separated by about 12 and a half feet, mm-hmm. okay, hit the ground in less than 9.6 seconds. That's the same as if you took a billiard ball in a vacuum and dropped it off the top of the building, okay? Mm-hmm. The story was that it pancaked, okay, that the 110th floor dropped onto the 109th, and then the added weight dropped onto the 108th, and it just kept building momentum and down, 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 and the whole thing collapsed like that, okay? Well, again, just for the sake of argument, let's forget about the 236 columns on the outside that it would have to break away from, and let's forget about the 47 columns in the center that it would have to break away from. And let's forget about all the non-load-bearing walls and all the stuff in the center that it would have to break away from, okay? The fastest the 110th floor could hit the 109th floor would be 32 feet per second per second. And, of course, that's cumulative. It doesn't start off. It only hits that after 32 feet.
Right.
Okay, so we're talking about a third of a second for only, you know, three floors, okay? So it would, once the 110th floor hit the 109th floor, assuming it could, what would happen? The 109th floor, again, we have Newton's third law. There would be an opposite and equal reaction,
right,
which would stop that floor dead in its tracks. There would be a transfer of energy, okay, at which case the 109th floor is now going to fall on the 108th floor, but it's going to start all over again at 108, at 32.2 feet per second per second. Mm-hmm. It's not going to build up. Each floor is going to have to start over from point A mm-hmm. in its speed. So it would take 97 seconds if all 110 floors had to go through that pancake process. Okay? If we said, all right, let's say that the it does it every 10 floors. 10 floors at a time do this. Now you're talking 31 seconds. Right. Still nowhere near, okay, the 9.6 seconds that actually happened. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, we know that each of the floors, as they hit, okay, what happened? It turned to dust. You can't have it both ways. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't have potential energy hitting the floor below it, transferring that floor to make that floor fall and turn to dust. Mm-hmm. You don't get it both ways. Either, theoretically, you have enough energy to turn that floor to dust. If that floor turns to dust, it's no longer a factor. It doesn't do anything to the next floor.
Right.
Because now the area, the dust, no longer can act on it because it's got too much air resistance because it's broken into millions of particles.
Right.
So you can't have a building, a floor turning to dust at the same time having enough transfer of momentum to make the next floor mm-hmm. fall. And even if it did, it would take 97 seconds. Mm-hmm. So we can see that it just isn't possible for the pancake theory to have occurred.
Right.
It violates the laws of physics, just like Newton's laws are violated with so-called airplanes hitting it, especially at a 26-degree angle in the seven floors.
Right.
And going through like a knife through butter. Mm. Cannot happen. Mm.
So with that, then, what happened to Tower 7, which did not get hit by a plane?
Okay, Tower 7 is another kind of the smoking gun. One which, in the last couple of years, more and more Americans are finding out about. But years ago, nobody knew about Tower 7. It was like everybody just thought in terms of Tower 1 and 2. Tower 7 wasn't even hit by a plane. And it didn't even fall until 5:20 in the afternoon, hours later. Okay. There was only a couple very small fires in that tower. It's another question. These buildings were all equipped with state-of-the-art fire extinguishing equipment. You know, if fire goes on, you know, and the sprinklers in the ceiling come on, you know. All buildings have that in them.
Which come out in the gallons per second measurement.
Yeah, gallons per second. And it's interesting that none of the buildings in the complex that day, their fire extinguishers work. You know, their fire systems work. How come these tiny little fires in Building 7, the fire extinguisher didn't put them out? How come the firemen couldn't put them out? You know, it's just... And again, here we have Building 7, which was 47 stories tall, fall in 6.5 seconds. Now, what's interesting about Building 7, as opposed to 1 and 2, Buildings 1 and 2 came down from the top. Boom, 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 each crumbled. Whereas Building 7, it was the opposite. The building came down, and it was as the bottom floor hit, it disappeared. So it was like a pile driver effect. As you're pushing it down, pretend you're putting your hand on the 47th floor, and you're pushing this building down through a shredder. And as the bottom floor hits the shredder, it goes poof, okay? So we have two opposite things happening here as the way these buildings collapse. So obviously there was two different ways in which they came down. Another interesting thing about Building 7, and this is a real smoking gun, mm-hmm. and we also hear at the same time we're going to talk about Building 6, which is a real smoking gun. Mm-hmm. After Tower 1 was hit, there was a man by the name of Barry Jennings, who was the assistant director for the Emergency Management Office for the Housing Authority in New York City. There was also a man by the name of Michael Hess, who was the corporate head of the corporate attorneys for the city of New York. He had a meeting that morning with the mayor, Rudy Giuliani, at Building 7. When the first plane hit, quote unquote, whenever I say plane, I'm always using it in quotes. When the first obstacle hit the building, the North Tower, Barry Jennings, in his capacity as the assistant deputy director, got the message that a plane had struck the building. He said, we heard it was a small plane, a little Cessna. Cessna 175 went off course and hit the building. He said, my following protocol was to immediately go to the emergency office management headquarters, which was on the 23rd floor of Building 7. That's where the bunker was for Mayor Giuliani's offices for an emergency management system. The city of New York had spent $20 million refurbishing the 23rd floor years before as headquarters in case there should be some kind of a nuclear attack or any kind of attack on New York City. I mean, the walls were bomb-proof, the glass was bulletproof, it had its own oxygen supply, it had food, it was virtually informable. It was impregnable.
Yeah.
So Barry Jennings, within minutes of the first tower getting hit, heads to Building 7. Michael Hess is coming to Building 7 at the same time for his meeting with Giuliani. Both come into the lobby. They get into the lobby and the electricity is off because after the building was hit, somehow there was a power failure for a period of time in that part of New York City. So they can't use the elevators to get up to their appointment where they're supposed to go. A security guard comes in and says, oh, don't worry, we have a special emergency generator back here. We can go up the back elevator. Mm-hmm. So they go up the back elevator. They come to the 23rd floor, probably within, say, 7-8 minutes after Tower 1's hit. They go into the room, and it's like a ghost town. It's empty. But there was steaming hot coffee cups with only one or two sips taken out of them. There was McDonald's chicken McNuggets with only one eaten, you know, hamburgers, whatever. The place was clearly just been occupied but was vacated. Mm-hmm. And they're sitting there and they go, gosh, where'd everybody go? You know? Mm-hmm. And so he gets out his phone, starts making the different calls, and he finally hits like a second or third person. He says, get out of there right away. Get out of there right away. It's not safe. The buildings are going to come down. Get out of there. Mm-hmm. So he goes, so he tells Michael Hess, we've been told to get out of here. He said, well, we can't take the elevators. We're going to have to go down the stairwell. So they start going down from the 23rd floor, and they get down to the 6th floor. And as they hit the 6th floor, there's a huge explosion, and the stairwell explodes. And Barry Jennings is hanging on the railings of the stairwell and he's helped up by Michael Hess back onto the steps. And there's all these explosions going on. Boom, 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 boom. And the building is filled with smoke, and they start heading back up to get back up to the 23rd floor. When they get up to the 8th floor, they go over to the window, and Michael Hess, and this is all captured on film. The news reporters are outside. He takes a fire extinguisher, and he smashes the window and says, "Help, help, help, we're trapped up here. We can't get out," you know. Mm-hmm. And the TV shows this fire department coming. "We'll get you. We'll get you. We'll rescue you. Stay where you're at." You know, and the fire comes, and they stop, and they turn around, and they run. They go, "We'll be back. We'll be back," you know. And so they were up there. Again, this happened about before the second tower was even hit.
Right.
And the building certainly hadn't collapsed. Mm-hmm. And finally, the fire department comes back again. They have to explode a hole in the wall. They get in. They get up to these guys, and they tell them, "Don't look. You're going to be stepping over dozens of dead bodies, and it's going to be a weird, really weird thing for you." So here we have the Twin Towers hadn't even collapsed yet, and we have explosions going off with dead bodies in Building 7. Mm-hmm. Okay. At, what do we say, like a half hour later, Tower 2 starts to collapse. At the same time that Tower 2, the South Tower starts to collapse, Building 6, which is between the North Tower and Building 7, there's a huge explosion coming from the center. And you can see it on the video cameras, the news cameras, because one is a different color. This one is kind of like a sandy white color plume, and the others are darker. Okay. Building 6 was like a huge, 50% of the building was taken out, like a big cookie cutter came right down the center of it and went and sucked everything right out of the middle. It didn't collapse. It was just like a cookie cutter took it out, and it collapsed at the same time as Tower 2 was falling.
Hmm. Yeah, that was part of my next question, is what other towers, Tower 7 has kind of been a recent thing that people have heard about. What other towers? So Tower 6, well, I mean, how about the other ones?
All the other towers were virtually destroyed. The only one that wasn't was the only building of the seven buildings that you could say was damaged because of stuff falling on it was Tower 3, which really wasn't a tower, it was the Marriott Hotel. Mm-hmm. And that did have some things that collapsed on it and caused fires. But all the others looked like they were exploded with a bomb. You know, there's these cookie cutters. And you can see, they had some film that went inside Building 6. And you can look, and there's nothing in there other than just, you know, some debris. But you can look around the floor, and all the outer walls are intact. Mm-hmm. You know, so if something's going to fall, it's going to knock down the walls. It's not going to go through the center like a cookie cutter and leave nothing on the floor. Mm-hmm. You're not going to look at the different floors in this building and say, "Where's the office furniture?" There's nothing there.
Right.
It's like a big vacuum cleaner went in there and went, sucked everything out of this thing. Now, another thing about Building 7, which is interesting, is that a half hour before Tower 7 came down, it was announced on BBC, British Broadcasting, you can see the newscaster with the film behind her, the live feed behind her, and she's being interviewed by this guy on BBC. And she says, "Yes, we've just heard that Tower 7, the Solomon Brother building, has also come down and has fallen to the ground."
I remember I watched that live, actually.
Yeah. And the man that's interviewing her looks at her and he says, "Now, isn't that Tower 7 right behind where you're..." She says, "Yes, it's right behind us, and it hadn't come down."
Right.
You know, it was a half hour before it came down. And the same was repeated on CNN. Same was repeated on Fox News. How did they know? It wasn't hit by a plane. It wasn't... There's no way in the world they could have predicted that Tower 7 was going to come down a half hour before. Mm-hmm. And it was scripted by all the different commentators on all these different worldwide news things that Tower 7 had come down. Also, they had Giuliani on tape saying that, he said, oh, the reason we left building 7 to go to a new command center is we heard the buildings were going to come down. So you heard them, they were going to come down within minutes after Tower 1 was hit by what you thought was a Cessna. Mm-hmm. So obviously there was all kinds of pre-knowledge,
right,
as to what was going to go down. This wasn't just a bunch of lucky Arabs with box cutters flying planes that they never could have possibly flown, mm-hmm, and hit their targets dead on,
you know, right,
and brought down all these other buildings as an accidental consequence, defying all the laws of physics. Mm-hmm.
Well, with that then, let's return again to our question about the planes. And, you know, because you laid out a lot of very good facts about that, that are all scientific, they're all verifiable. And, you know, have there been any pilots that have confirmed this? Any pilots that have said, yeah, there's absolutely no way we could possibly, you know, this could possibly happen?
Oh, yeah, there's John Lear, mm-hmm, who was the son of William Lear, who was the owner of Lear Aircraft, mm-hmm, who was the developer, the designer of the Learjet.
Right.
And John Lear is probably one of the most accomplished pilots. He's got over 20,000 hours of logged airtime in about 30 different types of airplane, both military and commercial. He also has degrees in aeronautical sciences. And John Lear wrote a 50-page brief to a court that was suing one of the... they were bringing on a lawsuit against NIST to show that their testimony was not scientific. And John Lear wrote this paper explaining all these things about how planes can't fly that fast at that altitude. Mm-hmm. And they can't. He also said, I wanted to rent a simulator to see. These people just think, oh, you can be up in an airplane. You can say, oh, there's a building, let's go hit it, you know. And like it's just like that. Like it's like driving a car into the side of the road, right? And he says, so I rented this simulator, and he says, I got different pilots of different levels of expertise to see how long it would take them to be able, in the time element that allegedly they had, flying at the so-called speeds that they said they were doing. And he said, none of us could do it. He said, I could start to hit. And he said, they hit the building, you know, center on, you know, like bullseye, boom, you know. And he said, I couldn't do it. Nobody else could do it. He said, after about 4 or 5 tries, he said, I was able to hit one of the buildings. You know, he says, but I've been a pilot for 30 years, you know. Mm-hmm. So to think that these, you know, these ragheads, you know,
right,
that practice on a 175.
Exactly.
You know, he says it's absurd, you know.
If they're half as dedicated to flight lessons as they are to their religion, when they're these Arab fundamentalists that are sitting there snorting cocaine and living with pink-haired strippers, so allegedly.
And Russ Wittenberg, who was another pilot, did a bunch of things like John Lear talking about. He actually flew 2 of the planes in his career that were allegedly used in the in the attacks. Mm. So he knew those planes. He says, there's no way this could have been done. He says, oh, another maneuver. I mentioned this earlier, but when the South Tower was hit, we're seeing the plane come from the right side of your television screen. You're sitting here, you see the North Tower in the back, already hit, smoking, and then you see this plane enter your screen from the right side, flies behind the North Tower, okay, coming at 590 miles an hour, they said. And all of a sudden, in 1/10 of a second, it does this 120-degree hairpin turn and flies into the side of the building. How is that possible? I mean, that plane would have to have been doing a number of Gs. And to think it could turn like that and not fly into a million pieces,
right,
and even trying to do it, and yet hit the building, is just ridiculous. So, I mean, the laws of aerodynamics, the laws of physics, the laws of flight knowledge just aren't possible. They started Pilots for 9/11 Truth. There's a whole group of pilots that have come on board and have analyzed this thing from every aspect.
I'll link that, too, in the episode notes for you to follow up on. So then the next thing is, in the wake of the some of the more recent, like the Malaysian flight that went missing and the flight that crashed in the Ukraine, it started to get floated in the media that they, that possibly a remote control was used to fly this plane. So then that got various people thinking, could they have used a remote control to fly the planes during during 9/11?
John Lear doesn't think at that time it would be possible, given the not that it's not hypothetically possible, but it would be very difficult. Of course, technology today is much better than it was 11 years ago, so what they could do today, I don't know. Of course, we all know it's possible to remote, because planes are, for a period of time, when they take off, they're under control of the power and stuff like that. But they're not doing complex maneuvers either, you know.
Right.
Another thing is if they were going to bring the buildings down with some kind of controlled demolition, okay, and all the time and effort that it would take to do that, why would you take the chance of taking airplanes on top of that to make it look like planes did it? Why not just blow the buildings up? Because too much could go wrong. Supposing the plane missed and crashed, you know, and was, you know, didn't hit the target, you know, and there's too many questions that could be asked. So it's John Lear doesn't seem to think that it would be very probable that could have happened, even though it's technically possible. Too many variables, too much could go wrong.
Right.
Yeah. It's
okay. So then the next question that would just made me think of there, when you mentioned controlled demolition. Now, how many tons of glass did you say were in these buildings?
Well, there was 600,000 square feet of glass. Let me just 43,600 windows, 600,000 square feet of glass.
Okay. So
transfers into probably 15,000, 20,000 tons.
Right. So now when you have a major explosion, you also generally tend to have a shockwave too.
Yes.
Isn't that correct? So, and then which would shatter these windows, I would imagine.
One of the things they do in preparing for a traditional, conventional, controlled demolition is they go into the building, if it has windows, and take all the glass out. Okay, because there's a compression factor. It's like an accordion, you know, when you push it, there's wind, and the wind's going to come out and make the sound, right? Well, if you have all these windows there, if you had a 110-story building with six, you know, all these thousands of windows in it, being compressed like an accordion, you've just converted glass into millions of bullets that will be flying probably, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of feet, you know, like shrapnel.
Right. Okay?
And yet there was little damage to buildings around them where, there was some damage of flying, but nothing like you would expect in that number of windows being shattered into glass and flying all over the place.
Right.
Matter of fact, you can see some windows and fronts on surrounding buildings that hardly had any damage at all. You know, so they didn't take the windows out.
Right.
The other thing with controlled demolition, when you do a controlled demolition, all you're doing is you're converting the mass of the building in one form and taking virtually that same mass and converting it into another form, a pile. You virtually have the same weight, the same mass, when you started and when you end.
Right.
Okay. The World Trade Centers, 95% of the mass is gone. I mean, you look at, there's no way that there's 1.2 million tons of stuff on the ground. It's very, very little is on the ground. And interesting, when they came in there to survey the ground and search, they figured there had to be 40, 50,000 file cabinets in these buildings. They never found any file cabinets. They found one tiny little piece of a file cabinet that was merged in a big ball like a crater with a bunch of other stuff. There was wood and this, and it was all kind of melted together like a big glass meteorite. And it's in a museum back there. You go, what is this thing? You know, so what happened to all this stuff? You would have had a blast, you know, that would have come down, that would have sent stuff all over the place. And yet you can see things parked around the buildings that were very lightweight that weren't moved. Mm-hmm. You know, so the building virtually turned to micro-sized dust particles as it was collapsing. Mm-hmm. In a controlled demolition, a standard controlled demolition, you get a little dust, and that's from where the charges were set up against the concrete. Mm-hmm. You're going to have some of that turned to powder, but just right. very minute amounts. The dust in New York City was around for weeks and months, some of it afterwards.
Right.
The dust was so fine.
Which caused the so-called 9/11 disease, which has killed so many of the firemen, the first responders, and others.
Yeah, and here's a case where the Bush administration came out and had one of their organizations, the EPA, come out and issue a report to all the people that there was no danger at all,
right?
You know, for the cleanup. So they forced the EPA to adjust their facts, adjust their math to prove that people was perfectly safe. Mm-hmm. And they say almost as many people died mm-hmm. after the fact from 9/11 disease as died in the collapse of the towers. Mm-hmm. All because of another government lie by the Bush administration. Right.
Bush regime, yeah. More correctly. So, all right then, another point. Preceding 9/11, there was a lot of insider trading going on. Later, the Securities and Exchange Commission shredded the entire report, although it was the largest insider trading investigation in history. What in the world is going on there?
Well, one of the things that happened is within a few days before the 9/11 attacks, there was a huge... See, the SEC monitors trading with computers. They look at the ratio of long buying and short selling to see if they're in proportion, okay? Mm. Now, there's a thing called a call option, which means you don't have to buy all the stock. You can just buy an option on the stock for a fraction of what the stock would have cost you. Mm. And if you buy a call option, it gives you the right to buy that stock at a certain, at today's price, at whatever it is tomorrow, you get to buy it at today's price. If the price is greater, you won. If it was less, you lost, and the option expired worthless. Yeah. On the other side of this, the coin, you have a put options where you're betting the stock market's going to go down. Mm-hmm. Anyway, within a few days before, the stocks on United Airlines and the stocks on American Airlines, there was a huge amount of put options bought, mm-hmm. way beyond the norm. And not just on United Airlines, but also on insurance companies, also on virtually any company that would have been adversely affected by a catastrophe of that nature.
Marsh & McLuhan.
Yeah, of course, the whole stock market came down, you know, right. as a result of it. So you basically could have bought a put option on any stock. Mm-hmm. But there was this huge amount. Basically, billions and billions of dollars were made on people buying these put options. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was never told who they were, you know. Certainly if it was Arabs, they would have come out and mentioned that. Oh, look at these Muslims, the whole Grand Mufti and his whole temple over in, we're buying, we're buying all these put options to make money on this.
Right.
They would have hung them out to dry in a heartbeat. So who actually did buy these things? Mm-hmm. Well, we do know one thing. It was clear through Deutsche Bank. Mm-hmm. Which was a CIA operation in Germany. Mm-hmm. And, of course, like you said, the whole operation was all torn up.
Even though it's the largest investigation yeah. in the SEC's yeah. history, period. Yeah. Standard operating procedure.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Business as usual.
And of course, the same thing happened at the time of the Kennedy, although they didn't have putting call options like they did today in the same way. Mm-hmm. All kinds of stocks were shorted.
Right.
You know, at the time of the days before the Kennedy assassination, billions were made then too. So there's, whenever some major event goes down, you can bet your bottom line it was well planned out and people knew about it.
Indeed. Well, this is bringing us to a close. So that one of the last couple of questions, most people, no matter how much evidence you present to them, and you've presented a lot of evidence that's just purely science, that's not just guesswork, or I saw this on Google, or what have you. I mean, this is science that can't mm-hmm. be refuted. And but people will still say, the government's too incompetent to have pulled off 9/11. The government can't fix a pothole. How can the government have pulled off 9/11 without people finding out? What would you say to that?
Well, one of the greatest conspiracies, quote unquote.
Conspiracy facts.
Yeah, conspiracy facts, quote unquote, that involved 100,000 people in three cities, three secret cities in the United States, was the Manhattan Project, you know, where they developed the atomic bomb in World War II. And nothing leaked. Nobody, there wasn't one little grain of sand that leaked out of that project. And one of the generals that was in charge of the whole thing, his wife says, my gosh, she says, I never had the slightest clue, you know, when all this was going on or what he was up to. So if a government's involved in a conspiracy, it's relatively easy because you can compartmentalize things. Everybody has this idea that you'd have to get thousands of people together and have briefings and tell them what they're going to do. No. When people work for the government, it's easy to separate people into all kinds of different compartments and say, hey, we're going to be running a drill today. Your job is to do this. Now, you have to take an oath because national security is involved. And if you violate this oath, you'll lose your job or you'll go to jail. Okay. So it's compartmentalized. The left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. The left hand thinks the right hand's doing something else. The little finger on the left hand doesn't know what the index finger is doing. Everybody has a different cover story.
Or in this case, what the middle finger's doing.
Yeah, what the middle finger's doing to America. Yeah. To our freedom and everything else.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So it's relatively easy. And this is why people say, well, look at all the sloppiness. Why did they leave all these trails? Because it's compartmentalized. It's like, you know, using the CGIs for the airplanes. Here's a thing where you see this plane going through a building. Its nose comes out the other side, perfectly intact, and then it withdraws and goes back into the building. That was a total mess up, okay? Because somebody screwed up. Somebody didn't get their job done right. But it didn't matter. They could cover it up. And, you know, people, you know, want to believe that their government is good and wouldn't do anything like that. So, yeah, so the whole thing boils down to compartmentalization, the cloak of national security, and patriotic cover stories, especially people in the military that have to obey or they'll be court-martialed. Nobody's going to risk their career. And who would you tell? I mean, when whistleblowers come forth anyway, what happens to them?
Right.
They get crucified.
Anthony Schaefer, Sybil Edmonds.
Linda Tripp.
Yeah.
I mean,
right. Russ Tice. Yeah. You can just start naming off so many people that have come forward to say X, Y, and Z and then declared insane, threatened with prosecution, harassed, chased out of town, suddenly discovered having committed suicide, or Gary Webb style with two bullets in the back of the head, but it was suicide, you know? Yeah. They just do that.
Yeah.
Things of that nature.
Shot himself in the head six times.
God forbid. But so, okay, that was a tremendous amount of information. And so, no, we didn't get to the who did it, and we didn't get to the how, because, well, we really don't have the answer. If we had the answers to that, then it would be case closed. And, well, we just don't have that.
I'd like to recommend a few books, if I could, here at the end.
Absolutely.
If somebody really wants to get into this and study it, I think the first book that should be read, well, the first person to write a book, and this was on the Pentagon primarily, and it's got a, was a French journalist by the name of Thierry Meyson, M-E-Y-S-S-O-N. He wrote a book called The Big Lie. And he later on, a few years later, wrote a book called Pentagate. And that was the book that really started this whole questioning about, hey, about the Pentagon, what went on there, how this is impossible. Mm-hmm. Another person that didn't come on the scene until 4 years later, he thought, I bought the government story. He says, I wanted to believe it. And then some friend of mine kept sending me information. So I used to be the kind of guy I am as I decided to investigate. And this guy ended up writing 10 books. It's Dr. Professor David Ray Griffin, who is a professor of theology and philosophy at Claremont University. He's now emeritus. But he's a brilliant man. Three of his 10 books, I think, are absolute must-reads. His first one is The New Pearl Harbor, about 9/11 and the New Pearl Harbor. The second one is The 9/11 Commission, Omissions, Distortions, and Errors in the 9/11 Commission Report. He goes through it with fine-tooth comb, shows how the whole thing was a cover job from A to Z. And his third one was The Mysterious Collapse of Tower 7. in which he goes through all the whole thing there. And so those three books would be very good. And if someone really wants to get in after reading those, find out all the details of what happened, all the laws of physics that were violated and everything else, I would suggest you read Dr. Judy Wood's book, Where Do the Towers Go?
Which is very controversial because of her conclusions, and a lot of people just cannot follow to that conclusion.
That's true. New ideas come hard. And it's like I said in the beginning, what Sherlock Holmes said, if you start off with a theory as to who did it, it's very hard for you to change your mind once you get committed. It takes a humble, open-minded person to do that, because what you do once you come to a hypothesis is you start cherry-picking, either consciously or unconsciously, about what things fit your theory and what don't, you know. And once you've committed a certain amount of time and energy, you don't want to give that up. So when somebody comes along and pulls the rug out from under your feet and says, what about all this other evidence, you know, they just immediately want to ignore that. Although more and more people are starting to, as more and more information comes, there's more and more people that are starting to back off and starting to listen to what she has to say. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay, excellent. So, well, thank you very much for all this. The next time we have Mr. Duddy on, we'll be talking about, back to theological topics, and we'll be talking about the question of for many and for all in the consecration of the precious blood in the Mass, which would seem at first to be, well, that's a moot point. They fixed that, didn't they? But nevertheless, it has a lot of very important theological implications that we'll be looking at. So until then, thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ryan.